Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
Kia ora, everyone. It's Dear Science time, and we're joined in the studio by Dr. Kushla.
Kia ora.
How are you today?
Very well, thank you.
That's awesome. We've got some pretty cool topics to start off the new year.
Yeah.
Happy New Year, everyone. This is the first Dear Science of 2026, an awesome one. We've also got Vihan here as well. Hello, Vihan.
Yeah, thank you.
Cool. Let's get it started. We've got this first topic is about how you can diagnose infections a lot quicker than it seems like you should be able to.
Yeah.
Under 20 minutes. That's crazy. No, tell us about it.
So this is really cool. So currently, if you get an infection, like if you're in the hospital and you get an infection, they might take some blood or they'll take a urine sample or, you know, if it's, you know, cerebral spinal fluid, like it kind of gets worse and worse in terms of the sampling and how they get it. And so then what they'll do if they think you're, you know, they've got to then take that sample and they basically need to do a process called culture. So they need to grow the microbes in it so that you get more of them so that you can use other methods to then try and figure out what they are. And this step of having to grow them can take hours, or it does take hours, and then it can take days in some cases. So once they have all that, they've grown those cells, they have that growth, then now, most of the time, what they'll do is they'll use a technique called MALDI-TOF mass spec. And this is basically a method that tells you about the proteins in the cell. And different types of bacteria and fungi have different proteins in them and different amounts. And so you get a different protein profile. And so it's like a fingerprint. You use you have a database that you compare that to, and you say, okay, we've got E. coli, we've got Staph aureus, you know, what have we got? And we can then... they can then select an appropriate antibiotic. But the problem is time, right?
Yeah.
So if you've got an infection that's related to E. coli grows fast, so this whole process can take 24, 48 hours. If you've got something that grows slow, like the bacteria that causes tuberculosis and stuff, it's going to take days. Some of those sort of slow-growing infections, they find other methods to test for, but, you know, it takes time. So what do you do in the meantime? Because you can't just leave the person there with no treatment. So they tend to use what is called like a broad-spectrum antibiotic. So the doctors kind of would know, based on your symptoms and your history, you know, it might be this, so we'll use this type of antibiotic.
Right, yeah.
And you hope it works. And, you know, like sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. You take that until they figure out what it is, and then you can have a more specific antibiotic. But, you know, part of this is what's led to antimicrobial resistance. And we all know this is becoming a major problem, right? Our antibiotics are becoming ineffective against the bacteria that infect us.
Oh, because they're, like, too broad.
Well, it's the bacteria themselves, when they're being treated, there'll be some of them that can resist, and the ones that resist then replicate, and so then they become more of the populations that we get exposed to, and so our antibiotics become ineffective.
Yeah.
And so obviously you want to treat the infection with the thing that's going to kill straight away, because you want to get better quicker and you want to try and prevent this antimicrobial resistance. So what this study has done is they've used a technique called Raman spectroscopy, which people have been using in this area for a while. And it's basically you shine a laser at the sample, you collect the light that comes back from that sample, and like with the MALDI-TOF, it's kind of giving you a fingerprint of the cell. So it's telling you about the amounts and types of protein and lipids and just the biological molecules that are in that cell. And so again, you get this spectrum that you can compare to a database and go, right, it's E. coli, it's Staph aureus again. And so why this method is quite cool is that you can apply it to single cells. So you don't need to grow up a lot of cells to measure, because you can just use it on single cells. But there's always another problem.
Yeah.
So if you take a blood sample, you might not have many of those cells causing the infection, depending on the bacteria and stuff. So you've got a lot of like solution, liquid, and very few cells. And so a bacterial cell is on the order of 1 to 2 microns, maybe up to 5 microns, you know, for the bacteria. So you're looking for a needle in a haystack, right?
Yeah.
And so you need to have some way of concentrating these cells in a volume so that you're not trying to like look for them forever. And that's where a big innovation of the study has been. They've built this thing called an auto-enricher. And so the idea is you can take your sample, so we'll say in this case of urine, put it into this device, and it goes into something called a microfluidic chip, which is just basically a chip that's got some really small channels in it that your fluid flows through. And then they basically pass it through a process where they extract the salts from the solution, and then it goes into an area that's got a specially designed electric field. And what this can do is concentrate and trap these bacteria. And so they can basically pass this fluid through, trapping these bacteria in one area. And then once they kind of know that, like, it's been some period of time, they can pass it to another area and then measure. And look, they've concentrated these cells, and you know where you're going to look for them. And so it's a lot easier. And then you can take your Raman spectra, you compare it to your database, and you get your answer. And so they're saying you can do this in 20 minutes.
Yeah, which is amazing. That would really speed up the whole process.
It's awesome, right? And now, so when you're doing this, comparing your spectra to your database and stuff, now typically these are starting to use AI methods. Mm. And so what they were able to do with this technology is they could detect as low as 2 coliforming units per mil, which that's essentially, for ease sake, 2 cells per mil. So that's really low.
Mm.
And with 95% accuracy in the lab. So they had some lab saved clinical isolates. So they were across 29 different types of bacteria and 7 fungi. And so they were compared that, and they 95% of the time agreed with traditional. So that's pretty good.
Yeah.
And then they actually did a patient clinical study. So it was mainly using urine samples, and they maintained the same sort of level of accuracy. So it's pretty amazing, really. And hopefully we'll see that technology develop. And
So they're still like in a testing phase.
Yeah. So they basically now... So that patient clinical study, it was just a small kind of proof of principle, and now what they'll need to do is a much larger clinical study across multiple hospitals and areas and stuff, and make sure that it holds up. Yeah,
I guess especially, I mean, if they're using AI with that, would there be any concerns with that element of it?
So you've got to be careful in terms of bacteria do evolve relatively quickly. Like it's called a phenotype. So it's like, because we're looking at the whole mixture of biomolecules in the cell, if they do start to become antimicrobial resistant, mm-hmm. you kind of have to add the spectra from those into your database. So you've a lot of database maintenance in that. And then with the AI, yes, you do have to really carefully test that it's giving you a true answer, right? Because they'll always give you an answer.
Mm.
So there's a lot of, as time goes by, you do need to check that these things are still working. And there's also been developments in this space where, you know, what if you get a bacterium that your database, it's not in there, it's never been seen before. So there are people that are now developing methods to account for that. So it's basically what the model would go, I haven't seen this before, I can't tell you what this is. And so there is a lot of development that still needs to happen.
Yeah, that sounds very good and important for sure.
Yeah.
So once this trial, once it sort of becomes official, will they start creating the antibiotics according to sort of, will the antibiotics be still, would they still be broad-based at all, or would they be more specific?
It will depend a little bit on the infection, I guess. And then it's... The use of antibiotics is an interesting one. The development of new antibiotics is something that requires a lot of investment, right? It's not something that appeals to pharmaceutical companies because it doesn't make lots and lots of money, like weight loss drugs and stuff. And so it needs a lot of government intervention. If you can have a more specific antibiotic that you know is more likely to work, then that will kind of be how they target it, and hopefully the consequence of that would be a lot less antimicrobial resistance development. But yeah.
Sweet. Let's check on to, I'm going to jump over to this next topic about the Danish chemist's invention, the technology to combat counterfeiting.
Yeah.
What is this? It's like something to do with fingerprints or something. I was trying to read and understand, but...
Yeah, so we use, you'll notice that scientists love to use fingerprint as an analogy for stuff, right? Because it's something we can look at. We know that from your fingerprints, they can kind of tell if you've been somewhere and such. And so in this case, the fingerprint is basically, it's this little 1x1 millimetre so a very small sort of tag that you can put on a product or on the packaging. And in this tag are some very, very small microparticles. So you can't see them by eye sort of thing. And what these microparticles have different sizes, and they're completely randomly placed. So basically they have a suspension that has these particles floating in it, and they spray it on. Now, what's also, so you get this random distribution and that, but also these particles, they have different dopants in them, which means that if you shine different wavelengths of light at them, they'll glow or not glow. And so you get a different pattern under different wavelengths of light. And so you've got these layers of information that are very hard to replicate, because you've either, you've got to know what the particles are, you can't really replicate random sort of spraying. Like, if you think, if you throw sand onto a pane of glass and then you like try and replicate that, that's kind of a nightmare.
Right.
And so that's what they're doing. They've basically developed technology to be able to do this. And so what you do is you have your very expensive handbag, and you inside you spray a little bit of this stuff, and because that the ink, the solution that these particles in, just dries transparent, and they take an image of it. Well, they have a recorder, and so it creates a database. Handbag goes out to wherever it goes, and then someone buys it, and they can just use their cell phone or whatever they store attachment or whatever, and they can take an image and go, yes, this is the real product, or no, someone's counterfeited this. Because reading this, I learned that in 2021, $467 billion of counterfeit goods were traded globally. Like, it's huge.
Yeah.
And it's not just about finance, right? Because if it's medicines and cosmetics, it's health. But the thing that didn't really occur to me is like electronics and stuff, where if you've got someone doing dodgy counterfeiting, they may not have the same sort of safety sort of requirements to their counterfeiting. So you get fires and all this sort of stuff.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, what are some of the, like, there are obviously some good benefits to having insurances around this, like not just about buying a good handbag or something like that, you know?
Yeah, no, and so one of the really, so they, because they've set up a company now that's actually in, it's got like 16 employees, and they're using this on stuff. So there's a company that's actually, they manufacture equipment like conveyor belts and stuff.
Right.
And they've used this technology because they're interested in the secondhand market and what they can and can't recycle. So they don't want their product, they don't want their machines and stuff getting a bad rep, right? So they need to maintain quality. And so they've used this tagging system to basically track where their stuff, where their machines turn up and what they're doing and stuff, and better understand like the market and the secondhand market and that, so that now they can actually recycle some stuff a lot more than they used to. Mm. And so there's kind of a, like, it's improving their business from a sustainability aspect, which it's not where my mind would have ever gone for counterfeiting.
Yeah. but that's super helpful. Love that for it. Okay, we're going to go on to our last topic. This one I thought was the most interesting one, which is why I saved it for last. It's about climate change and how much people think it will affect them compared to other people. I think that's so interesting. Tell us about this research that they found.
Yeah, so this is really interesting. It's all about an individual's perception of their risk from climate change, right? So emphasis on the perception. So it's not measuring the actual risk these people are facing.
Yeah, right.
And so what this has done is, it's called a meta-analysis. So when, what that is when you collect together a whole bunch of published studies around a topic and you basically aggregate the data. So you go from being smaller level studies to this big, large thing. So in this case, they put together 83 studies that covered 17 countries, and it had information from over 70,000 participants. So, you know, you're starting to give your conclusions more power because you've looked over a wider sort of distribution of people and stuff.
Yeah, for sure.
And yeah, what they found was that I think it's up about like 65% of the people or whatever they perceived their risk from climate change as being lower than other people.
Just like a general other people.
Well, yes, this is where it also got really interesting. So that was general other people. And they did find that there was a difference between, if you said compared to just general other people or compared to a location that's not really under threat of climate change. So, you know, not any of the Pacific Islands sort of thing. Or then they'd go to a very specific location. And so that had an effect as well. So the biggest difference between the perceived risk and stuff was when you just went others. So it's kind of it's not my problem sort of philosophy.
Which has such massive implications for how people think about how much they need to be caring about this issue.
Exactly right. And this is the point they were making. It's like, well, if we don't think it's a problem for ourselves, what's our willingness to actually do anything?
Yeah, it's like the other side of the world problem.
Yeah, and so it's kind of the not in my backyard sort of philosophy, right? And so they're kind of going, well, yeah, we need to understand this because it is probably having an impact on the measures that we're taking on an individual level, but also, you know, individuals influence government in most countries. And so, you know, if your government is inclined to do stuff or not inclined, and you know, so it's incredible. And the one thing that was really interesting as well, so they had these 83 studies they're looking at, and two studies was it the opposite, where the people that were surveyed perceived their risk as higher than others. And those two studies were covering farmers in China and South Korea who had actually suffered from extreme weather events and climate-related risks. So when you had experienced it, your perception definitely changed. So it would be really interesting in, you know, 10 years' time, if you looked at the data, like how has it shifted with time and now seeing more extreme weather events.
Yeah, well, there must be, like, there's so many people around the world, I'm sure, now who've experienced, like, the intensity or frequency of these climate events that are happening and don't seem to connect the dots there.
Yeah, I think it will shift because, like, you know, like, these, I can't remember what time scale these 83 studies came from, but they would have, you know, like, been not so much of the recent sort of things that we've seen maybe over the last five sort of years. But it's really...
Could it even be taken from like maybe even an empathetic sort of view? Like, oh, I recognize that climate change is a problem for me, but I see that other people are like seeing it way worse. Is that...
Possibly. So that is the other thing. So it's a really interesting study for going... Yeah, there's the science to it, and then there's their perception of it, right?
Yeah.
And then how the two disconnect, and yeah. So I think the empathetic thing could actually be a good reason too.
That's such an interesting study.
No, it's also such a paradox because, like, most people in the world know climate change is real, but the study still shows that, oh, it is real, but not too much for me, but other people maybe.
Yeah, it's probably over there still somewhere.
It's real, but not so much for me. So do I need to stop using my car so much?
Exactly. That's such a cool study. So thank you so much for sharing that with us. And that is all of our topics for today. So thank you for the very first Dear Science for 2026. Thanks for joining us. Thank you, Motat. And as always, thank you, Science. That was Dear Science for this week. We'll be right back after a short break. Keep it on the beat.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.